Hello, welcome to CityWire's Funds Fanatics show. I'm Jeremy Gordon, assistant editor of Funds Insider here at CityWire, and I'm excited to be presenting this podcast for the first time today, particularly so because I'm joined by fund manager Keith Ashworth-Lord. Keith manages Sanford de Lan's UK Buffettology Fund, a strategy modelled on the principles of legendary investor Warren Buffett, but focusing on UK shares. The fund hit its 10-year anniversary in late March and had returned 277% to investors over that decade. That was one of the best performances in its UK all-companies sector, where the average return was 94%. But perhaps even better, the fund also beat the 256% gain a UK investor would have got from owning Berkshire Hathaway stock over those last 10 years. In other words, Keith has been beating Buffett at his own game. Keith, welcome. Now to start, congratulations on UK Buffettology's 10th anniversary. What do you think has been the secret to your success running the fund so far?
I think it's the methodology that we use, business perspective investing. All we ever do is look at companies, markets, companies' position within markets. That's what we drill down into. We don't concern ourselves with all the extraneous noise of where stock markets might be going or where interest rates might be going, trying to second guess things. We devote our entire life, investment life, to drilling down into companies, economic analysis, financial analysis.
Okay, and can you tell me a bit more about how you develop that philosophy, and I suppose why it works?
Oh, it's purely a take on what Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett have done over the years. Basically, we're looking for businesses that have an economic moat. So businesses with pricing power, with growth potential in their markets, or perhaps their markets have got growth potential. And we look for a variety of telltale signs. So we look at growth, we look at margins, operating margins, we look at return on capital, return on equity, cash conversion, strength of finances, the balance sheet. Do the managers act with the eyes of an owner, or do they act like expensive management consultants, or worse still, empire builders? So we're really looking at a whole gamut of both financial and human characteristics about a business that tell us that this business might have an economic moat.
Okay, and this is still what Warren Buffett does himself today? Say buying and holding a company like Coca-Cola for three decades plus, and then you put your own kind of spin on those kinds of ideas.
Yeah, I mean, let's say at the outset, he's the sorcerer and I'm the apprentice. He's been doing this for years, whereas I've only been doing it for 35 years. Well, actually, this methodology I've been doing for 25 years. First 10 years were lost. It's that whole long-term buy and hold philosophy, that once you've got a really great business, there are so few of them about that you really should just stay with it through thick and thin and only sell if something material changes, either the business, something in the business, could be economic, could be market, could be regulation, could be management, could be almost anything, but something fundamental has changed. Or the alternative is, you've made a mistake and you've got into something that isn't what you thought it was going to be. Those are the only reasons we would sell. Otherwise, we want to hold for 10, 20 years.
Okay. And you told me once when we spoke before that a company called Games Workshop was a 30 bagger for you. In other words, it's gone up 30 times since you bought it. And in fact, it's still your biggest holding today. Can you explain to me a bit about how Games Workshop is an example of that philosophy in action?
Yeah, we bought it in April 2011, right when the fund started, and we paid 373 pence at the off. And as you know now, they're over £100 a share. That's a business that has definitely got an economic moat, and that moat comes from buying a piece of its customer's mind. The people who play this game, the hobby with these miniatures and all the gaming books and scenery and everything, they're absolute fanatics, and they will spend their last dime on that hobby. It really is a case of fanaticism writ large. So it's a consumer business. But it's one where the the consumers are really locked into the whole world of Warhammer. A really great, strong franchise. Nobody else is doing that. You know, they've got intellectual property here, and it's a fantastic business. And the really interesting thing was, after 5 years of ownership, the shares were still only at £5. Remember, it was £3.73 I paid. And we were getting implored by investors. What are you doing sticking around in this business? You know, it's no good. Go and get into something else that's moving. And all the time, I just sort of sniggered and thought, look, I tell you, my operating ratios and my financial ratios are telling me that this company is executing on everything it said it would. And one day, the market will realise. What then helped even more was we had the referendum and we had Sterling take a tanking, and 75% of Games Workshop sales are overseas, and yet all of its manufacturers is at Lenton in Nottingham. So it had a wonderful currency factor. It also got a new manager in Kevin Rowntree, who'd taken over from Tom Kirby. And Kevin's proved to be very, very sassy. He's got them involved with social media. He's introduced new games that have gone down really well with the gamers. And the whole thing has just snowballed. It's been a great trip.
Okay, that's very interesting, Keith. Thanks. I'm curious. So you're talking about Warhammer, which is Games Workshop's core business, this kind of leisure pursuit where people collect these figurines and then kind of pit these armies against each other in battle. I'm guessing, to be honest, you don't play Warhammer yourself. When you're trying to go about understanding businesses, is that sometimes a challenge that you're a bit far removed from what they do?
No, not in this case. I think it was probably an advantage. I think if I'd been a gamer, I might have had stars in my eyes about it, whereas I was one step back from all that. But it was just so obvious that when you wander around the place, the people who work there, they're so enthusiastic about what they do. You know, they really, they're hooked into it. The gamers themselves are hooked into it. And, you know, when you go around somewhere, when you kick the tires on a business and you encounter people with such enthusiasm for the job that they're doing, you want to bottle it. It's a wonderful feeling. And the only other one which is remotely like that, in my experience, has been the business that's actually our third best returner, and that's Focusrite, the music products game. Again, fantastically enthusiastic employees and people using the product really like the product. So, you know, nice combination to have.
Okay. And so you talked about buying Games Workshop when it was around £3.70, and then several years later still languishing, so to speak, at £5, and people saying, what are you still doing in this company? And now it's absolutely rocketed, and I expect the questions have flipped round, and many times people are saying, why aren't you taking profits on this holding that's done so well? Can you talk to me a bit more about your philosophy on taking profits and whether that's the right thing to do often?
No, I go back to what I said earlier. There's only really two good reasons for selling a holding. One is that you've got it wrong, and two is that something's changed. I mean, in the case of Games Workshop, the thing that strikes me is it's by no means penetrated all the world. You know, there's a lot more to go for, and they've just spent 2 or 3 years investing in both manufacturing and distribution facilities down at Lenton for this next phase of growth. The other thing they're doing, which is absolutely right, is they're exploiting their IPR. So their royalty income is rocketing, and royalty income is wonderful. I mean, there's no cost attached to it, it's pure profit. And I just
think, this is in things like computer games, is it?
Yes, yeah, that sort of thing. And I just think there's an awful lot more to go for. The rise in the share price has been a mixture of both earnings expansion and also PER expansion. So it's not been one or the other. It's been a nice combination of both. I just think there's an awful lot more to go for. Why would you sell a business that's on a roll?
Okay. So it's very far from being a sort of niche offering that's filled its niche.
Absolutely right. I don't think it's filled its niche at all. So much more to go for. And, you know, the other point is a lot of it is sold through third-party stores, you know, through retail. More than 45% is retail through through other distributors, other stores. And if they were to get that business in-house, there's additional margin there to capture as well.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Keith. Something I was definitely keen to ask about is whether you think, you know, Games Workshop is a kind of once in a decade company, or whether there are other names in the portfolio that you think could do that well. You mentioned Focusrite. Can you talk to me a bit more about that business and what the strength of its economic moat is?
Yeah, Focusrite is an audio products business, and it was originally two distinct products. One was sort of synthesizer type products under the Novation banner. Everything from these pads that you tap on to make music, right up to sort of smaller synthesizers. And the other side of the business was consoles, digital, for mixing. Not really, I believe they do go into Abbey Road, but not really big studio oriented. It's mainly sort of mid-sized studios and small independent music makers, people. And of that business, they've now built up with a couple of acquisitions, Adam and Martin Audio. They've started to add products to it. And most recently, they bought a business in the United States, which is high-end synthesizers. So it really is, it's for people who want to make music or who want to record it in studios. And if you ask anybody who uses the product what they like about it, they'll say it's not the best on the market, but it's the best in terms of the price levels that they're pitched at. So, you know, the people who are using the product really like it. And as I say, it's a business where the managers, you know, Phil Duddridge has got over 30%. He's the founder and chief executive of it. The managers have all got big stakes in the business, so we like that. And they're all dyed-in-the-wool music industry people. You know, Tim Carroll's the CEO. I think I said Duddridge was the CEO. He's actually the chairman. And Tim Carroll's steeped in it. These are people who really know their industry backwards, and they know how to reach out and capture their customers. It's a great little business. And we bought it for the first time. I think it was an IPO in 2014. We bought it for the first time in 2018, early on 2018. And already it's a three-bagger getting on for a four-bagger for us.
Okay, that's very interesting. What one thing on Focusrite? So I believe that your fund has got about a 5% position in it, and Focusrite isn't a particularly big company. My rather amateurish arithmetic calculated that you might own about 10% of the shares in the Buffettology fund alone. Is that a problem at all? Is that something people should worry about ever when you've got big stakes in the underlying company?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, if you've got a business that you really do believe in, then you really ought to commit capital to it. Where you'll go wrong is by spreading your capital out over a whole load of things that you don't know as well as the big ones in there. We've got a number of sort of 10, 15% holdings. Quartix, we own 18% of, for example. As far as we're concerned, it's a focus investing approach. And that's what we want to do. We want to have a small portfolio of, you know, 30, 35 companies that we really think we know an awful lot about and hopefully know more about than most other people do. We think if you're going beyond that, instead of having a portfolio, you're going to end up with a zoo, and you're not going to know those businesses anything like as well as you should do. So it's what Buffett says, you know, if you're going to put your eggs, a few eggs in the basket, make sure you watch the basket. And that's what we try to do.
Yeah. And I don't want to ask too leading a question, but given it's the kind of 10th anniversary of the fund, I was wondering, when you started in the UK, investing in UK shares with this kind of approach, did you feel like you wanted to do something very different to the other options which were out there?
Yeah, I mean, Sir John Templeton said, if you want different results, you've got to do different things. And that's absolutely right. There are people out there, there's a coterie of fund managers who are doing very similar things to what I'm doing. You know, I mean, think Nick Train or think Terry Smith. Really sort of nailed onto a very robust investment philosophy. But there's an awful lot out there who, you know, perhaps are not so focused as we are. I mean, I think one of the things that enables us to do that, quite frankly, is the fact that we own our own management companies. We're not employees of somebody else's company. We don't work for Schroders or something like that. And it gives you that, you don't have quite that career risk of doing something different that you would if you were working for a big house. So I think that's one of the features of why a certain group of individuals like we are all are able to invest the way we are. But yeah, I mean, this whole philosophy, you know, it started with me in mid-1990s when I started going over to Omaha and I started reading a lot. I'd latched on to Buffett and Munger and Philip Fisher. It was that I'd almost discovered. It was like Damascene conversion. You know, I sort of came across a philosophy that I felt very, very, very comfortable with. And suddenly all that, you know, previous 10 years of going mad trading and all this sort of thing, it just went clean out the window. And once you've crossed that particular line, you never go back.
Yeah. So you said you've been over to Omaha a few times. I guess that's for the legendary Berkshire Hathaway annual meetings. Can you tell us a bit about that experience? And did you meet Warren Buffett himself?
Yeah, the very first time we went out there, my then business colleague, a chap called Jeremy Otten, he and I ran a publication called Analyst, an investment research publication. And we were very, very fortunate in that Warren and Charlie gave us about a quarter of an hour of their time. It was actually in Susan Jakes's office, the CEO of Borsheims. We met them. We'd been to press conferences and things, but that first meeting was really quite something, you know, especially when you just got on these tram tracks. And we got to know a whole group of people out there, you know, who collectively are known as the Buffettologists, you know, Lowenstein, Kilpatrick, Cunningham, Dave Clark and Mary Buffett, who, of course, licenses the trademark Buffettology. It's great. Yes. I mean, you go out there to cleanse the soul.
Cleansing the soul, crikey. You talked about that first meeting. What was the kind of particularly memorable stuff from that? What really stuck with you?
One thing that stuck in my mind and I've repeated ever since, and it was Charlie Munger in a short part of that conversation. He said, Keith, watch the incrementals like a hawk. We were talking about return on equity specifically at the time, but he said, watch the incrementals, watch the delta, what's happened over the last year, 2 years, 3 years. So marginal returns on equity rather than average return on average equity. He said, because quite often the marginal will tell you if something's going right or wrong long before it's reflected in the average. So he said, watch the incrementals like a hawk. And I've done that ever since.
So I suppose that's all about knowing the businesses you're investing in really well and watching very closely for these leading indicators of where performance is improving or slipping. Is that right?
Correct. I mean, the models that I use, in a lot of cases, you know, Games Workshop, my model starts in 1994, and I've got all the financial information. And what we've put together is not just the P&L, balance sheet, cash flow data. We've put together a whole sheaf of about 150 key ratios that are derived off those sort of value drivers of the business. That's the proprietary bit, actually, of what Sanford DeLand do. Dependent upon certain businesses, certain of those ratios will be more important in the context of any particular business. But that's what we watch like a hawk. And there's a lot of delta goes on in that. Interrogating the delta is what I call it. Looking at subtle changes and what it might mean. And it's a great model to have because it actually gives you the questions that you need to ask of the managers when you meet them. It's terrific. I remember once Nathan Imlach, who was the finance director of Mattioli Woods, we were having the meeting and he said to me, where are you getting these questions from? You know, it was like, I don't know whether he thought I had a mole on the inside or something. And I said to him, I said, I'll show you. And I went around the other side of the table with the spreadsheet and the ratios. I said, that's why I asked you that question, pointing something out to him. And he said, I've never seen anything like that before. And I said, well, you won't have, because this is what's been developed over many years. And then his final comment was, he said, can I have a copy? I said, no. Nope.
Okay, that's very interesting. Must be, yeah, a very compelling model. I'm curious, Keith, and do you still follow closely what Buffett is up to today? I think the answer is probably yes, given, if I'm not mistaken, according to Morningstar data, that the fund actually has a small or a position in Berkshire Hathaway. Is that right?
It does indeed. We have two US shares in the fund. The two businesses are Berkshire Hathaway, surprise, surprise, and the other one is Rollins, which is the second largest pest control business in the United States.
Okay.
This philosophy, this methodology we use, it crosses borders. That's why it's made for a global fund as well as a UK fund. But it's just that I know the UK better than I know. Well, I know the US quite well because I live over there part of the time. But
oh, right.
Yeah, we have a home in Florida. We've had it for many years now. We try to spend about three or four months over there. That's another cleansing the soul operation, by the way. The joke is,
I'm sure, yeah.
The joke is, whenever I go over to Florida, the fund always performs better.
Excellent. And so, I suppose it's fair to say maybe that Berkshire Hathaway's performance returns haven't been quite as strong over the last decade as previously. Buffett doesn't really like tech. He's backed companies in struggling sectors like banks and airlines. Do you think he's gone off the boil at all?
No, I don't. I think what it is, I think it's the size of the business now. It's a huge business. And if he were running a fund that was the size of my fund at 1.6 billion UK, he'd be doing an awful lot better than he would with Berkshire Hathaway. And I don't think your intro where you bigged me up as having beaten him on performance, I suspect if he were running a fund same size as mine, you know, I'd be trailing on his coattails. So I don't think he's lost it. I tell you what, I wish I had a tenner for every time people have asked that question, has he lost?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I see.
I don't think he has. And I mean, in terms of the tech, you know, He's got Todd Combs and Ted Wechsler now, who's helping him on the investment management side, you know, investing the float. And I think clearly their influence can be seen in some of the recent things, the Apple stakes, for example. So he's got some interesting people around him.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure if Warren Buffett ever does launch a UK equity fund, there will certainly be a lot of interest, let's say. One other thing I'd like to clear up about your investment philosophy, if that's right, Keith. Again, kind of referring back to Buffett. At one time, you know, Warren Buffett was considered a legendary value investor. But looking at your fund, it seems like it's much more about growth. Can you kind of explain that? Is there any contradiction there, or kind of what should we take from that?
Right. At the outset, I would say I don't recognise those two imposters as growth or value. I really don't. I mean,
okay.
I mean, value, I'm afraid, has a connotation of rubbish, trash. It's cheap stuff, and quite often it's cheap for a reason. So I mentioned earlier on that what we do is we look for businesses that have growth potential. The markets have growth potential, or they have growth potential in the market. So right at the top of the equation, we're looking for businesses that are in growing markets, which have that potential. And after we've gone through our whole quality of business assessment and our economic and our financial analysis, only when we've really decided we want to invest do we even think about valuation. And we're fairly simple folk. We just try to work out how much cash do we think this business will give us from now till judgment day, discount it back at a fairly high hurdle of 10%, and then compare what we get with what the market is asking us to pay. And if it looks like it's a fair valuation, or even better still, it's a cheap valuation relative to what we can buy, we will invest there and then. Conversely, if it looks somewhat overvalued in the market, we'll put it on a watch list and we'll just wait and we'll wait and we'll wait and we'll wait until either the market has a funk or something happens with the business and maybe the market takes a downer on the business. But obviously we think it's solvable, whatever the problem the market's seeing is. And then we would invest. And, you know, there are examples of that. If you think back to 2018, when the final quarter, the market took a bit of a tanking, we loaded up on both Experian and London Stock Exchange at what now look like very, very good valuations. And they'd been sat on the watch list, businesses we wanted to own, but we just initially didn't have the opportunity. So that's where the value aspect comes in, i.e. we want to pay. Price is what you pay. Value is what you get. And we want to make sure that we always get value for our money. Because, again, you know, the price you pay determines the return you're going to get. So we think value and growth as just two ends of the same process, really, and not as, you know, as I called them earlier, imposters to be pitted one off against the other.
Yes. And, well, I suppose when you were outlining your philosophy at the top of the conversation and talking about an economic moat and strong return on equity and those kind of qualities, I think reasonably people would say, well, these businesses are probably going to be expensive. But I suppose that's your answer to that kind of concern then, that you really are very patient about waiting for the right entry point.
Absolutely right. And I mean, the other thing is just to mention, if you're discounting things back at 10%, that's a very high hurdle rate. So you are actually building a margin of safety in by the discount rate you're using.
Thank you, Keith. Now, the fund hasn't been quite as strong a performer since November's coronavirus vaccine breakthroughs, which have ushered in what some might call a value rotation. But I think you've called it a dash for trash. And the fund's performance was slightly negative in the first quarter. Are you worried about this rotation to value and cyclical stocks?
Not at all. I've seen it before, and it's usually measured in months rather than years. And then the quality businesses pick up the baton and run with them. We're already starting to see that. You won't have seen the April figures yet, I suspect, but we did quite handsomely beat the market in April. And I think the reason for that is that over April and May, we've had about 20 of our companies reporting either results or trading statements, with just one or two exceptions. They've been up to scratch, or in several cases, better than scratch, e.g. Focusrite. And I think the consequence of that is that we have seen a one-month rotation back to the sort of businesses that we like. I'm not going to say it's the end of the so-called value rotation. It might not be. Who knows? You know, that's the sort of thing I don't even worry about. But what I do know is I've seen this before. I've seen periods, 2016, where we underperformed for several months and then we took off again. It's what will happen. It's just, you know, it's sentiment driving the market. And all it does, if it means that the quality businesses, you can get them at a better valuation. And I'm very happy about a rotation to value.
Okay. And have there been some examples of you being able to buy quality businesses at better prices?
Well, if I talk about the last few months, there's been one or two that we've added to the portfolio. Businesses like Trifast, which were down on its uppers. Before the bid came, businesses like Scarpa, and that's been taken out at twice the price we were buying stock at. Even better, if we go back to this time last year, you know, when the whole market had tanked, we were getting some fantastic opportunities among our leading companies. So, you know, Games Workshop picked up at just over £47, Focusrite at £3.90. You know, these are two I've mentioned, obviously, a number of times on this call. So we've had some great opportunities to buy into what I think are quality businesses at prices that make business sense.
Okay. Thank you, Keith. It'd be good to talk some more about some of the other holdings in the portfolio. The kind of low-cost travel group Jet2 is one of your biggest holdings. I'm curious, can those kinds of cyclical companies really be examples of the very strong, enduring franchises you look for?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd say Jet2 is actually a 20-bagger for us since we first bought it back in 2011.
Really?
It's another big one, yeah. Why do we like it? I'll tell you why we like it. The people who run it are very customer conscious. If you look at the reports, the people who've had money out with them, they've got their money back straight away, their rebates back straight away. Jet2's not sat on it. It's run by Philip Meeson, as you know, who owns a big slug of the equity. Under him, he's got two really good managers in Gary Brown on the finance side and Steve Heapy on the CEO side. And this is a business that is not... It's at secondary and tertiary airports. So, you know, think Leeds, Bradford, think Stansted, think Bristol, think Newcastle. And those places have been pulled out of by the likes of Chewy and EasyJet and Ryanair. They've abandoned those, and Jet2's got stronger at those secondary and tertiary airports. Then on top of that, they've had this wonderful attrition going on in the industry. You know, we saw Monarch go, we saw Thomas Cook go, and consequently Jet2's position strengthened as a result of that. And now we see Chewy Thompson in trouble, maybe going to retrench from the UK even more. So it's going to leave Jet2 really in a very, very sweet spot when we all start flying again and taking off. So we like the business, we like the managers, and we like the way they treat their customers. And I think there really is a franchise. Our chief analyst all travels Jet2, and he says it doesn't matter if him and his family with wife and two kids, he says they're quite happy to pay a lot more money to go with Jet2 than with any other rival airline because of the standard of service. So that's why we like it. It is different from most of my businesses in the sense that it's quite capital intensive, and most of my businesses are asset light. But yeah, yes. It's a business that, again, I've known for donkey's years, you know, when it was Dart Group, and it had Fowler Welsh, of course, as part of the group in those days. So it's a business I've known for an awful long time, and managers that I really respect.
Okay, thank you. Lion Trust is another top 10 holding, close to 5% of the fund. I'm always curious when fund managers invest in other asset managers, I suppose. Lion Trust does have this big sustainable investing fund range. Is that an important part of the appeal there?
You just picked on another 20 bagger there with Lion
Trust. Another 20 bagger, oh dear.
What do I like about it?
I need to be more incisive, don't I?
What do I like about it? When I bought it for the first time, it was not long after John Irons had taken over and working with Vinnie Abril to turn it round. It had a bit of trouble, in the sort of noughties. And what I liked about it was its funds were performing really well. You know, they were all top quartile over 1 year, 3 years, and in most cases, 5 years. There was nothing wrong with the performance of the funds and indeed the way the senior managers were turning things round. But what really struck me was, you know, this is value. This is real value. It was at 0.75%. Enterprise value to assets under management, and the next cheapest was Brewin Dolphin at double that level. The median was about 2.9%, and the high water mark had just passed when Franklin Templeton bought Rensburg for 4.9%. It just looked absolutely dirt cheap, and the underlying business was in a transition phase and getting better, in my opinion. The other thing I've got to like about them, I know them a lot more now. You know, we try and meet up every 6 months and go out for a bite to eat and just chew the cud a bit. And the thing that I really like is the culture of the business. It's very similar to Sanford de Land in cultural terms. I also liked the economic advantage model. It's not a million miles away from business perspective investing. And now, as you rightly say, they've got the sustainable range that augments the economic advantage model. Where do we stand on that? We don't put the ESG horse in front of the car. We do pay a lot of attention to ESG, particularly the G bit, I have to say. It's all part and parcel of business perspective investing, because you're looking for businesses that are going to be around for 10, 20 years. And if you gouge your customers or you treat your suppliers badly or your employees badly, you ain't going to be around for long. So we do have our checklist that we use. We don't shout from the rooftops about it, and we certainly don't badge our funds as being sustainable or ESG, but it does actually go into that process.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Keith. You mentioned buying or adding to London Stock Exchange at a pretty attractive valuation last year.
No, 2018.
Oh, 2018. Sorry, my mistake there. The shares have been struggling a bit more recently. There's been this big acquisition of Refinitiv, if I recall correctly. What's the outlook like there?
I think the problem with the Refinitiv acquisition is that it's probably not turned out to be quite what they thought it was. I think it had more difficulties there. And they're certainly talking about it costing an awful lot more money than we've been led to believe and taking longer to integrate. So that, I think, is the reason why, you know, the sort of the gloss came off a bit on the last statements from them. My own feeling is there's one or two other things. You know, they did gear up very heavily instead of having maybe an equity issue to part finance it. And they did it before they'd sold Borsa Italiana, which, of course, they've now done. That's gone through. So I think there were one or two things there. And now we've had this whole question about Schwimmer's remuneration and you know, the increase before we've seen the results of the integration of Refinitiv. So I think there's an awful lot of good reasons why the shares have come off what was a pretty full valuation at you know, £90 plus. I mean, it really was, it was priced into perfection at that level. So it doesn't surprise me that they've come off, you know, down to more like the £70 level. I mean, I've got to say, we were buying in at 40 to 50 when we had that market funk. So it's not something that particularly concerns me. And we'll just stay with it. It's a different business now, of course. I mean, it was once a trophy asset, you know, the London Stock Exchange. It's not that anymore. It's trying to become more of a data business. And we like data businesses. We fundamentally like data businesses, subscription models, you know, high retention rates. That's the sort of business that we really do like. So it's got a lot. It's got a lot to attract me, but it's also got something to prove now.
Okay, thank you. Seeing as I've picked out a few 20 baggers already, it's probably important to highlight that the process doesn't always work quite so perfectly. Provident Financial saw a bit of a blow up recently, and you sold that stock in March when it was heavily down. The company faced a lot of complaints about its doorstop lending condition, which has just announced it will close, I believe. Do you have any regrets there, or is that kind of thing just that sort of setback sometimes crops up?
Oh, there's the right old story here with Provident Financial. We were in that from early days, and we actually sold out when they tripped up over their new operating structure and what they were trying to do with the business. You probably recall that the shares fell from a high of over £30 down to about £5. We actually sold out ahead of that because I thought the whole rationale, the costs were spiraling. I actually thought the business was just beginning to unravel, fray at the seams. And we sold out at prices between £20 and £21, actually I think just above £21. And then, you know, look, what a clever boy am I, it looked like for a while, as the shares tumbled down to you know, 25% of that level. But what then happened was Chris Gillespie, who run the home collected credit business with aplomb, I might add, for many years, he came back in to sort it out. This was after Peter Crook had been taken outside and shot. So he came back in. And I thought, yeah, he'll get this sorted because he knows this business inside out. So that was my theory about why I went back in. And I actually re-entered at around about £5, thinking, yeah, it could be dead money for a year or two. But, you know, we should be all right with this one. It's been around since 1880. I've personally known it since the 90s. I get it wrong. Yeah. You know, when you saw that trading statement in March, I mean, it was absolutely peppered with things to give you concern. And I just thought, yeah, you know what, you got it wrong. You were clever the first time, you've been pretty dumb the second time. So I cleared it out and just hands up, got it wrong.
Okay, thank you, Keith. To slightly change tack, last autumn you tried to launch a UK Buffetology investment trust. which didn't quite raise enough money to get off the ground. Was that a big disappointment at the time? And do you still have ambitions to launch an investment trust in the future?
Let's take the latter part first. Yes, it's sat in a drawer not to be revisited when times are right. Yeah. What happened was, we were getting a fantastic reception when we started off. When we started off on the marketing, and I thought we were going to knock 100 million into a cocked hat. I really did. We were really building a head of steam, getting a lot of traction. It was clearly a product that the market wanted, and that's why we'd launched it in the first place, because people were coming to us telling us that that's what they wanted. What happened? I'll tell you what happened. On October the 12th, Boris Johnson opened his mouth about a lockdown. And on October the 13th, the day after, we saw interest waning, or rather our marketers saw interest waning.
Right.
And then it got worse. It got worse because Boris Johnson started arguing with his Red Wall MPs and some of the elected mayors up here in the north. The whole thing started to turn a little bit sour, and we actually saw orders pulled from the book. So the last 2 weeks of the marketing period coincided with us having been tripped up politically. It's pure and simple. That's what it was. It was lockdown and its impact on confidence. And I remember thinking at the time, I wish to God politicians would think before they opened their mouths, because if we were seeing that, my guess was it was happening throughout the economy, and it was likely to be having a bad effect, you know, on the real economy. So that's what happened with it. We've had a lot of people come back to us saying, are you going to revisit it? You know, we really think there's a place for a product like this for closed-ended small cap businesses where, you know, you can bring your expertise to bear. The answer is yes, but we've just got to get it right. You know, it's not just the cost, sinking a lot of cost into a product that never saw the light of day or never got off the ground, would be a better analogy. But it's also reputational. You can't fail twice to get it away. So we've got to be absolutely sure. And there's an awful lot going on in the business at the moment that, you know, we don't judge the time is just not quite right at the moment.
Okay. Well, perhaps it sounds like a case of watch this space then.
Very much.
Perhaps that's a good point to wrap things up. So, Keith, thanks very much again for joining me. It was a real pleasure to talk to you again, and very interesting to get a kind of deep dive on your approach.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And I suppose the final thing to add is thank you very much again for listening today. And please join us again soon for more Funds Fanatics Show podcasts.